On behalf of ITRC, welcome to today's training, Characterization and Remediation of Fractured Rock. My name is Devin Setchkar. I will be your moderator today from Arlington, Virginia. Okay. This training is an introduction to the associated online guidance document noted on this slide. This guidance document was produced by ITRC in 2017. We cannot cover all the information, tools, and resources available in this guidance document, so please visit the website and take a look at it if you have not already done so. We hope it will serve as a resource for you as you work on your environmental sites. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or ITRC, and is hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as CLUIN. Some housekeeping rules for today. This training is scheduled for 2 hours and 15 minutes, and as I said, is recorded. While we are in the Zoom webinar, you are unable to access the live web links on our slide deck. You can, however, access them through the slide deck offered on the CLUIN website. You can download those slides and follow through on your own, and those links are active. In Zoom, you have access to the Q&A window where you can ask questions or report technical issues at any time. We will have 2 question and answer breaks during the training, and we'll get to as many questions as we can verbally. If we have too many questions to answer out loud, we will ask our trainers to respond directly back to that person in writing through the Zoom Q&A chat. There is an online feedback form for you all to complete to let us know how the training went today. By completing this feedback form, you'll be eligible to receive your certificate of completion to support your documentation of continuing education. At the end of the feedback form, you will check a box certifying that you participated and submit the form. You will then be emailed a certificate. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of States. We are a state-led organization composed of over 1,000 members from state agencies, the federal government, private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. Our members participate in technical teams which produce tools, resources, and training courses, such as the one you're participating on today. If you would like to be a part of ITRC, please visit our website or feel free to contact us directly. On our website, you can register for teams and learn more about how you can become an active member. The full ITRC disclaimer is available on our website as well. If you do plan to use any ITRC materials, we ask that you review the policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC accordingly. ITRC is partially funded by the US government. ITRC nor the US government warranty the materials nor endorse any specific products. On slide number 5, I appreciate the opportunity to introduce our expert trainers. All of them have been active members of ITRC's characterization and remediation of fractured rock team over the years. Not only do they serve as volunteer trainers for ITRC, they have dedicated many hours to develop this guidance document. A special thank you to all of them for participating today. So with that, I'm going to hand it off to Dave to start us off with our first section. Dave.
Okay. Let's see here. Well, it looks like we're missing some of our slides in this presentation here. So I'm going to kind of ad lib as we go along here. This is looking well to get through here. I apologize for this delay. Okay, I'm just going to start with a general introduction here. Good afternoon and welcome everyone. The Fractured Rock team that developed this training course and the associated document are a highly experienced team of geologists and engineers from across the United States and Canada, representing state and federal agencies, academia, and the environmental consulting community. So let's take a look at the figure I have up on the screen right now. And I want you to notice the added elements of the fractures, folds, bedding planes that create a complex network of contaminant migration pathways. Without proper site characterization and a well-developed conceptual site model, costly mistakes are more likely. The strategy and tools presented in this document were developed to help you gather the information you need to make good decisions and help you develop an effective remediation strategy. Moving on, our pyramid diagram represents how an initial problem can start small, but if not properly addressed, the problem expands and the challenges are compounded. We start with a basic premise that fractured rock sites are complex. Unfamiliarity with the local and regional geologic setting and unfamiliarity with the site characterization tools leads to uncertainty in the conceptual site model and unrealistic remedial action objectives. The investigations in fractured rock can be technically and financially challenging. Each step needs to be carefully planned and thought out based on detailed understanding of the geologic setting. For example, if you take a look at the diagram we have up on the screen right now, you may have an idea of the general direction of groundwater flow on a macroscopic scale, but fractures, bedding planes may significantly alter the contaminant transport and change things on the local scale, what we might call the mesoscopic scale. Continuing with our pyramid of uncertainty diagram, we see how increased uncertainty leads to increased characterization costs, ineffective remediation design, and increased long-term remediation costs. The fractured rock characterization document provides potential solutions and remedies, allowing you to flip this pyramid over and understand that there are resources available to manage the complexity of bedrock sites. We need to think of fractured rock hydrogeology differently than unconsolidated porous media. Okay, so to make use of your resources, gather as much information as you can before drilling the first hole in the ground. Gather available geologic maps for rock type and structural contours and identify the structural symbols. In some cases, you may be able to measure the strike and dip of fractures and the aperture of partings in the field, or you may be able to collect data from outcrops or existing wells in the area. At one of my projects located along the bluffs of the Mississippi River, we were able to measure the orientation of vertical fractures and identify seeps at a contact between two formation members before we ever began drilling. At another site a few miles away, we were able to, there really weren't any outcrops available, but we were able to access golf course irrigation wells, industrial process wells, and municipal supply wells to utilize downhole tools and identify bed partings and high transmissive zones in an aquifer 250 to 465 feet below the ground surface. As outlined in the document, we will use published data and field data to understand the aqueous and vapor contaminant flow pathways to develop and refine our conceptual site model. So what are the appropriate tools for assessing the fractured bedrock hydrogeology? Later in this webinar, Tamsin's going to introduce the tools matrix table. And in that, you're going to see in the left column how various downhole geophysical tools can be used. And then along the header to the right contains your site-specific geology. Since this web-based document that's available through the ITRC website is an interactive document or a matrix interactive document, it links you to fact sheets for the various methods that are being used. Using the right tools for your particular situation will help generate the data you need for a detailed and accurate conceptual site model, which in turn help develop objectives that are specific, measurable, applicable, relevant, and time-bound. We like to use the acronym SMART for that. Also, the conceptual site model will help develop an effective remedy and achieve the remedial action objectives. This guidance is the fourth document in a succession of, I think it was six ITRC documents produced in the last 12 years that builds on the ITRC's 2010 mass flux and mass discharge document, the 2011 integrated DNAPL site strategy document, and the 2015 integrated site characterization document. Later on, we followed the fractured rock document with two additional ITRC documents, one being the advanced site characterization tools released as a web-based document in December of 2019. And then in February of 2020, we released the optimizing injection strategies and in-situ remediation performance document. Some of you may be planning to attend the optimization injection strategies training on March 3rd. When trying to understand the geology and develop a conceptual site model, we often think of it as a puzzle. We need to put each puzzle piece together to understand the contaminant storage, fate, and transport. Geology is going to be the green puzzle piece that we use throughout the document. It covers the physical characteristics, type of bedrock, and physiographic province of the site. The blue puzzle piece is hydrology, which discusses the contaminant flow characteristics of the fractures and matrix. Chemistry is in purple and addresses the characteristics of the actual contaminant. The guidance further introduces parameters necessary for developing a fractured rock conceptual site model and stresses the need for an experienced multidisciplinary team. To help you understand the similarities and differences between bedrock and unconsolidated porous media, we developed three trees and placed one tree below each puzzle piece. This is your translation tree, how to translate the familiar concepts of geology or hydrology into the bedrock terms of the unconsolidated media terms. The rounded rectangular branches on the left represent fractured rock properties, and the oval branches on the right represent the corresponding concepts of unconsolidated or porous media. And then here we just took the geology puzzle piece and expanded that to a larger size so you can get an idea, a better view of how this is set up. Today's webinar follows the same order as the chapters in the document. John Doherty will cover geology and physiographic provinces in chapter 2. Melissa Boyson is going to cover hydrology in chapter 3. Chemistry, fate, and transport, chapter 4 will be covered by Ted Tyler. And then we'll pause for our first question and answer session with Devin and the trainers before we resume training with Tamsin Macbeth, who will discuss tools to develop the conceptual site model in chapter 5. Dan Bryant will cover remedy selection, chapter 6, and John Doherty will return to talk about developing a monitoring strategy in chapter 7. After John's section, we'll wrap up the webinar with another Q&A session. So our next speaker is John Doherty, senior hydrogeologist at CDM Smith in Edison, New Jersey. John, take it away, please.
Thank you. Hi, everybody. So when we start working at a fractured bedrock site, we want to start from the regional setting and then zoom into the site-specific setting in the process of developing our site conceptual model. So in looking at it in a regional setting, we can see the topography, drainage, and landforms, which give us clues to the bedrock characteristics that influence groundwater flow. This example is from the Piedmont Physiographic Province, you know, in the eastern part of the United States. And it's evident here that there's a northeast to southwest fabric to the landscape related to the orientation of bedrock layering. And this gives us an initial clue that we may be seeing this influence in groundwater flow such that it'll be northeast to southwest or southwest to northeast towards discharge. Then coming in at a smaller scale, getting down closer to the site, you know, we look at the outcrops and the rock itself. So here is an example of a metamorphic rock with foliation, which creates a layering and a trend in the anisotropy of the rock. This stream valley, in fact, follows the axis of foliation or layering in this system here. So we'd expect groundwater to also follow this orientation of the layering as well and create anisotropy in the system. So now looking at our initial site conceptual model, without drilling a borehole, we can begin to formulate this CSM, assembling information from the different sources or different sources, including the location, drainage patterns, and bedrock characteristics. So on the right-hand side here, we see two different scenarios where we have our source, discharge location, and groundwater supply wells, and then different isotropic versus anisotropic conditions. So in the isotropic scenario, this could obviously apply to an equivalent porous media, but it could also apply to a scenario in rock where, say, the rock is flat-lying and the bedding planes or foliation that we've been talking about are flat-lying. So it acts more like an equivalent porous media, meaning that groundwater flow is going to be basically towards discharge, depending on where the source is relative to that, to the discharge location, which in this case is the river shown here. In contrast, in the picture previously, remember, we saw the tilted rock. So now what was flat-lying is tilted, and it creates an anisotropic effect, this being, say, the orientation of bedding or the orientation of the foliation. So now the effect on groundwater flow is to promote groundwater flow along this axis of anisotropy, regardless of the position of the source relative to discharge or supply wells, in contrast to the situation in isotropic setting. So this is an example early in the process where we can use information like this to start to get an understanding of what we can expect groundwater flow from the source to be doing in these different settings. So let's look at a real world example of how these concepts are applied. This is a site in, it's like Maryland, okay, where gasoline was spilled, and they collected samples and drilled wells, or collected samples from supply wells all around this area. They installed, as you can see, a large network of monitoring wells, but they found non-aqueous phase liquid consistently in this set of wells along this line here, which happens, not surprisingly, to line up with the orientation of the bedrock foliation in this case. So that's a powerful example of how this bedrock property constrains where, in this case, the gasoline was moving. So one of the tools in the fractured rock guidance is a framework here for organizing and evaluating elements of terrain analysis. So we include receptors, the regional setting, lithology, structure, anisotropy, heterogeneity, and hydrology. And they're arranged here in this format. This is in Appendix B, and it helps you look at your site and decide, start applying these tools. So if we have sedimentary rock, what's the orientation of the bedding? Is it horizontal, inclined, et cetera? And then based on that orientation, what kind of anisotropy can we expect? And then what about heterogeneity? And what does the drainage pattern look like that we can expect with this type of rock setting? And then last but not least, of course, is karst. Now, karst is discussed in Appendix A of the document, but the focus of our document is really on secondary porosity in bedrock formed by physical or mechanical forces. And karst terrain occurs and forms things like sinkholes due to chemical dissolution of the underlying rock, typically a limestone. And they can be strong indicators. Of course, you can have very, very large secondary porosity features in karst terrains, including voids, conduits, and caves that can have a significant influence on groundwater flow and transport. But again, our focus in the bulk of this document is on the kind of secondary porosity that's caused by fractures or faulting or joints that occur in sedimentary rock frequently, and also in metamorphic and igneous rock. So with that, I'll hand it off to Melissa.
Thank you very much, John. So for this section, I'm going to start us off with a poll question. So if you could bring that up, please, Devin. All right, so for this question, I'd like you to just take a look at these three answers and think about what, you know, which of these things is the most important for determining flow in fractured rock. Now, while you're considering your answer to that, I'll take us back to this drawing or this diagram that was introduced earlier by Dave. Now we'll take a closer look at the middle portion of this of that diagram. And you'll see, you know, just the differences in how we, how we compare or how we investigate and how we consider fractured rock over here on the left versus the stratigraphic or versus the unconsolidated porous media over on the right. So in fractured rock, you're looking at consolidated rock layers or continuous crystalline rock versus unconsolidated porous medium. For permeability, we consider fracture apertures and fracture connectivity rather than the grain size and the sorting of the unconsolidated matrix. The porosity is in both the fractures and in the matrix, as opposed to just a single porosity that we often see in the unconsolidated matrix. The flow direction, as we saw with the as John just showed us, can often be anisotropic and is controlled by fracture orientations and bedding planes. Whereas in unconsolidated deposits, it can be isotropic or anisotropic depending on depositional settings. And then fracture aperture, you can have laminar or turbulent flow, but this is most evident in karst. And again, I can refer you to the karst appendix of the fractured rock guidance. The hydraulic advection, this bottom one here, is controlled by the structure and the fracture connectivity rather than individual hydrostratigraphic units. So, Devin, if you could please bring up the results for the poll question. So I see that the consensus was the last answer, how does it move? And really there is no correct question for this or one single answer for this question, because it really does depend on the specifics of your project site, the project goals, and the stage that you are at in the project. So you can go ahead and close that poll question. So to help you answer those three questions, I'd like to review some of the terminology that is presented on this figure, which is figure 2-3 in the guidance document. You'll also hear a lot of this terminology throughout the training today, and you've already heard some of it. So thinking about where is the fluid? Well, it's either in the matrix, which is this unfractured portion of the rock, or it's in the individual fractures. Some of the characteristics of those fractures include the orientation, which is the geometry of the fracture with respect to the land surface typically, but sometimes we'll also talk about it with respect to other bedding planes and layers or other fractures even. We would also refer to this feature as strike and dip or dip and dip direction. The aperture is the thickness of a fracture opening, and the terms infilling and dissolution are processes that refer to the changes in the overall porosity of that fracture. The length is how long or extensive that fracture is, and density and connectivity refer to how many of the fractures there are and whether or not those fractures form a connected network. The planarity and waviness of a fracture refer to whether or not that fracture is straight or undulating along its length. And then if you focus in on the fracture surface, roughness is the term that refers to how irregular that surface is. Now, the way the fluid moves through the fractures depends on the fluid properties, whether it's water, napple, or vapor, but also the fracture characteristics that I just described. So for example, if you've got a very rough fracture surface or thin aperture, it could impede or slow down your flow. Now, fractured rock is just the general term that we use, but when we're characterizing the rock, we're looking at the rock type and whether it is sedimentary, igneous, or metamorphic, the latter two being the crystalline rocks. So this photo here is from the Grand Canyon, and the purpose of it is just to show you a side-by-side difference in sedimentary and crystalline rock. So the sedimentary rock at the top here is dominated by this orderly layering formed by the deposition of each unit. And the crystalline rock that you see here below is more massive. The layering isn't as visible or prominent here. And the dominant structures you see are related to fracturing. Now, this is an oversimplification, so I'll just break it down for you a little bit more now. So this is a cross-sectional view of sedimentary layers. So we've got the land surface, if you can imagine, is up at the top, and we're looking down into the ground surface at some sedimentary layering. So when characterizing sedimentary rock at your site, you're looking at both the fracture porosity and the matrix diffusion and their relative importance. Now, depending on the sedimentary rock type, the fractures can represent the dominant flow path, but where the rock has more porous and open matrix, some of that overall flow may be within the matrix. The bedding planes can create preferential flow pathways, and that's why you see a couple of different plumes here in these two different bedding layers. Layers can also isolate different plumes. We can also end up with different hydrogeologic domains. So we've got the different plumes, but we also have different equipotential across those bedding boundaries. So the fracture systems within sedimentary rock can be more orderly or predictable within the layers, but they can also often change along different lithologic layers depending how strong or weak that layer is. In addition to rock strength, the composition can also control the extent to which the mechanical and chemical weathering affect fluid migration in fractures. For example, increasing aperture size or infilling and decreasing it. So this is another cross-sectional view, and this time we're considering a crystalline rock site. And in this case, the fractures may be the only significant porosity that we see in the system. Depending on the fracture distribution and density, the fracture sets can also represent relatively isolated hydraulic systems, similar to the behavior that I showed on the previous sedimentary example. So the numbers on this figure aren't important to the discussion, but you can see here the weathered bedrock is this middle layer right here. And you can see that there are quite a few fractures in it, and we've got contamination going through those fractures. And this shading here kind of is meant to represent that you've got some of that contamination can get into the matrix just at the edge of those fractures. Now, as you flow down into the more competent layer, which is this layer right here below, we have fewer fractures, and you can see that we've got a lot less of that absorption into the matrix adjacent to the fractures. So in the case of metamorphic rocks, you might also observe the layering that you saw on one of the earlier photos. And some of those layers may have primary porosity. Depending on the composition or how metamorphosed that rock is. The fracture systems in crystalline rocks are caused by local or regional forces, and they can be more orderly or predictable in layered metamorphic rocks or more chaotic in igneous rocks. The notable exception to that would be where you have columnar jointed basalt, where the vertical joints formed during cooling are very regular. As with sedimentary rocks, the composition can also dictate the extent of mechanical and chemical weathering and its effects on fluid migration. For example, chemical weathering of rocks with high feldspar content can leave behind clay minerals that end up filling in the fractures. So when we discuss fluid flow in fractured rock and how to drive our investigation approach, we look at the rock matrix porosity, we look at discrete fractures, and we also look at interconnected networks, and finally, how these three things interact within the rock. Now, the matrix porosity is where the water and dissolved constituents can reside in the unfractured rock, though they may not contribute much to the overall flow in your system. You may, however, need to direct your investigation to the matrix when your primary consideration is storage and/or release of constituents from the matrix. Discrete fractures can be large, and if they are long, they could also transport constituents long distances from the source. But if they're not well connected, they may have a limited importance on your investigation, except for the storage that they represent. And then where you have an interconnected network is usually the primary focus early on in an investigation, because this is where most of the flow is occurring and probably where your wells are screened and sampled. So as with the poll question at the beginning of this section, there isn't necessarily a right or wrong answer for which of these features is most important to focus on, because it really does depend on the project stage and the overall goals for the site. So I'll briefly touch on some of the fluid-specific factors that just to get you thinking about how flow may change through your fractured rock system. Fluid flow is driven by pressure and density gradients. So in this figure, for example, the red lines here represent potential flow pathways. Starting at the land surface, you may have many potential flow pathways through the overburden or unconsolidated rock. But going into the saprolite or this weathered bedrock layer here, there are fewer potential flow paths. These paths require higher pressure and density gradients for the fluid to migrate as the fracture aperture and pore size decreases. And then fewer still as you moved into the less fractured bedrock. When there are multiple phases involved, such as a knapple, and it encounters the water table, you need to understand the pressure that's required for that phase to migrate. You need to understand which of those is the wetting phase, or the phase that coats the surface of the pores and fractures, or the non-wetting phase, which is what the phase that fills in the remaining pore space. I'd also like to direct you to the fractured rock appendix of the LNAPL update for additional information on the specifics of NAPL flow in fractured rock. So other considerations include whether your fluid is moving slow or fast. And there may be a scale dependence on this, to where turbulent flow may dominate at the scale of an individual fracture, but across an interconnected network, it may more represent laminar flow. So for the rest of this fracture flow section, we're going to focus on the scale of an investigation and when certain attributes are most important. So this graphic is figure 3-1 in the guidance, and it's a qualitative summary of the scale at which you would focus on certain attributes of the fracture characteristics, the hydraulic properties, the flow mechanisms, and transport mechanisms. In the following slides, we'll focus on these three scales up at the top here, macroscopic, we'll start with, then mesoscopic and microscopic. We'll look at how each of these are defined and how each scale is typically investigated and the information that you get from each of those scales that helps you shape your conceptual site model. It's also important to note that these scales should only be investigated to the extent that's practical for your site and for a particular stage in that project lifecycle. So macroscopic flow occurs at the site-wide or regional scale where the remote sensing tools that John mentioned earlier are more applicable. This is where we look at features at how such features as faults, rivers, tides, and major changes in lithology can influence flow. Fracture attributes such as the orientation, length, and connectivity are important here. And overall, the flow behaves like a laminar flow system. Investigations often begin with a regional overview, and from this point, you can better define the direction that the investigation needs to take as you progress to smaller scales. At the mesoscopic scale, you're focusing more on the plume delineation and the flow between the boreholes and wells. The attributes such as the orientation, aperture, density, the length, and the connectivity are the focus of an investigation. And I'll get to the poll question in just a moment. At this scale, the matrix interactions start to become more evident. Because this is the primary scale at which we investigate a site, there's no shortage of tools for hydraulic testing or fracture analysis. And we'll go into that in more detail a little bit later in this training. But before we move on to the next scale, we'll go ahead. And if you haven't already, please do answer that poll question. And I would just like you to take a look at this and say, which of these is a general representative range of in situ fracture apertures in the upper few hundred feet of rock? So how thick is a typical fracture within the first 100 meters or 100 feet? Sorry, just a moment. Okay. If the answers are ready for that poll, could you please bring up the answers, Devin? All right. So the answer is actually B. So that would be the second one. So 0.05 to 0.5 millimeters. And that's actually the thickness of about 5 sheets of standard paper. So the data from this actually comes from a New England case study site that will be presented later on in this training. And it also shows a good example of the change in the fracture aperture with depth. So thinking about that 5 millimeters or 5 sheets of paper, that's the typical microscopic scale that you would be dealing with. And this is where the primary focus is on the morphology of a fracture and the intersection between fracture and matrix. This is typically done through direct measurement on rock core samples. And at this scale, you may be focusing on the morphology of a fracture and how the aperture changes across the length of that fracture, or with depth even. You may also investigate diffusion and capillary flow at this scale. And while this scale is not typically used to delineate plumes, it may become an important scale when it's time to start thinking about a remedy for the site and answering the questions, where is the bulk contamination located and how can a remedial technology reach that contamination? So you can go ahead and close the poll question. Thank you. So we started this section out thinking about those three main questions. Where is the fluid? Are there multiple phases? And how does that fluid move? These questions are all important depending on your site needs. You should now be able to take this information and add it to your conceptual site model. If there are multiple phases at the site, you've started to look at how those phases interact. And you've also considered the data across multiple scales. The next step will be to consider how this information helps you to understand migration of chemicals. And with that, I'll introduce Ted Tyler with Cardno, now Stantec, who will talk about fate and transport. Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa. So we've talked about the geology and the hydrogeology of fractured rock, and now we talk about the fate and transport of contaminants within fractured rock, beginning with a high-level overview of some of the common fate and transport mechanisms, inclusive of density-driven vertical migration as the contaminants migrate downward under the influence of gravity, dissolution and advection to the extent that they dissolve into saturated fractures, matrix diffusion and back diffusion that occurs as related to sedimentary rock, and then sorption retardation to the extent that there's organic matter along the fracture walls, as well as degradation inclusive of abiotic and biotic transformation that may occur at your site. Now, some of these are illustrated in the graphics on the right, beginning with the top graphic. This is a crystalline rock that is fractured, and you have a contaminant dissolve phase migrating through via advection through the fracture. Being a crystalline rock, there is no primary or matrix porosity, and as such, there's no partitioning into the rock matrix. And so the dissolve phase advances at a certain rate as compared with the middle graphic, which is now a sedimentary rock. And this has a primary or matrix porosity such that there is partitioning of that dissolve phase into the rock matrix, effectively slowing the rate of advance of the dissolve phase. And then in the third lower graphic, this is again a sedimentary rock, but also with the naturally occurring organic matter on the fracture walls, such that there's both matrix diffusion in the rock's matrix, as well as absorption going on along the sidewalls of the fractures, effectively even further reducing the rate of advance of the dissolve phase. So it's instructive to consider the properties of contaminants as they relate to the fate and transport in fractured rock settings. So for example, with trichloroethylene as shown here, we might identify the liquid density or its tendency to sink below water, vapor pressure, and Henry's constant reflective of the likelihood of finding vapors in the source area, vadostone or unsaturated fractures, or as related to partitioning from the saturated fractures down gradient, as well as solubility, its tendency to dissolve into the saturated fractures, or even KOC, its sorption coefficient, reflecting its tendency to sorb to the fracture walls. Then finally, reactivity, reflecting whether or not this is a contaminant that is amenable to, say, abiotic biochemical geotransformation. So it's possible to color code this to highlight fate and transport mechanisms that perhaps deserve more focus as you move forward with your decisions for your site. This is perhaps more applicable if you have multiple contaminants and you want to see at a glance what those fate and transport mechanisms are that deserve attention. For example, blue might be used to highlight a chemical that is going to sink below the water table based on its density, or green representing a contaminant that is likely to be present in the vapor phase in the source area, and or partitioning from the saturated fractures in the down gradient extent with implications for soil gas surveys. Purple would be reflective of a contaminant that has a strong dissolve phase, along with in the case of sedimentary rock, strong potential for matrix diffusion and long-term back diffusion. And then brown reflecting the chemical with a strong propensity for adsorbing to the fracture walls. And then pink could be reflective of a chemical that is in fact amenable to, say, abiotic biogeochemical transformation. So moving now to contaminant mixtures, beginning with Dean apple. As illustrated on the right and discussed in the bullets on the left, looking first at the top graphic on the right, the release of a Dean apple in a sedimentary rock is going to migrate downward under the influence of gravity through vertical fractures, as well as finding its way into horizontal fractures under the influence of hydraulic gradient. Over time, as shown in the middle graphic, the Dean apple will dissolve into the saturated fractures as well as partition in the rock matrix as represented by the dark orange shading. And then over a longer period of time, the late time, the lower graphic here, the Dean apple and the high concentration dissolve phase is no longer present. However, that reservoir of mass held up in the rock matrix back diffuses, potentially sustaining concentrations above cleanup levels in the saturated fractures. Continuing with contaminant mixtures, looking at light non-aqueous phase liquids, And beginning with a refresher on the concept of strike and dip, strike being the orientation of a fracture relative to the horizontal plane, and dip being the angle of a fracture relative to the horizontal plane. As indicated in the first bullet and illustrated on the graphic on the lower right, in the special case of a vertical fracture, an LNAPL will migrate downward along the dip until encountering the water table. Being less dense than water, will then proceed to move along the strike. Implications for site characterization of this are that in the special case of a vertical fracture, the core holes and monitoring wells in the vicinity will be unlikely to intercept that fracture and or to find the LNAPL. In addition, in this further special case of a horizontal fracture, hydraulic gradient could additionally influence the migration. I would also point out that as that dip moves away from vertical, the likelihood of encountering that fracture increases or in intercepting it with a core hole or a monitoring well, and so finding the LNAPL. Now, comparing that with a DNAPL, same concept of strike and dip, as indicated in the first bullet and illustrated again in the lower right, a release of a DNAPL will migrate downward along the dip until encountering the water table, will proceed to fall below the water table, being more dense than water, and until either running out of mass or encountering the bottom of the fracture, at which point it will then migrate along this strike. In addition, in the case of DNAPL, you see that lighter orange shading here reflecting the dissolve phase that results from this. Now, implications here for site characterizations are, again, moving away from the source zone, you can see that shallow wells would miss the DNAPL. In addition, in the special case of this vertical fracture, core holes and monitoring wells will be unlikely to intercept the fracture and will be unlikely to see that dissolve phase. However, as the fracture moves away from vertical, you can see that the likelihood of encountering the fracture and, in this case, encountering that dissolve phase increases as the dissolve phase presents a greater footprint relative to the surface. Then once again, as with LNAPL, in that special case of horizontal fracture, the hydraulic gradient will again influence the migration of DNAPLs. Moving now to the 21-compartment model, this is based on the 14-compartment model that was developed several years back by Tom Sale and Chuck Newell, and as documented in the ITRC's integrated DNAPL site strategy document, it is adapted here for application to weathered bedrock or to fractured bedrock. And it is a representation of the CSM. It is not a replacement for the CSM, but it is a representation at a level of resolution for making high-level decisions with regard to setting characterization objectives, screening technologies, and so forth. The structure of the model is such that on the top row, you have source zone as well as downgradient extent. These are further subdivided according to relative transmissivity into matrix storage, matrix flow in some cases, flow through the rock, as well as fracture flow. In addition, on the far left column, these are further subdivided into the particular phase of the contaminant. So looking at an example, this is a release of a DNAPL into a poorly cemented or friable sandstone. The colors here represent the relative colors. This is qualitative. You could make this more quantitative with site data, but qualitatively, the orange represents a high amount of mass, the yellow represents a moderate or medium amount of mass, and the green represents low mass. So the release of DNAPL, in this case, will find its way downward via vertical fractures, is represented by the orange, will partition into the vapor dissolved in sorb phase above and below that, as well as move to the left, moving into the rock matrix itself as matrix storage, and also in this case, matrix flow. In addition, the dissolve phase within the source zone can migrate via advection to the downgradient extent, and then similarly partition. Now compare this to the same example of a DNAPL release in a shale bedrock. The first thing we notice is the matrix flow is no longer a consideration. So the model simplifies in that same release of a DNAPL finds its way down in the source zone into the fractures represented by the orange, partitions into the different phases, as well as into the rock matrix as matrix storage. And again, that dissolve phase can migrate down gradient and similarly partition. And then in one third example, this release of a DNAPL in a granite that is fractured, we see that the 21-compartment model simplifies even further. So there's no longer matrix storage. neuromatrix flow component, and we're focused on fracture flow. So that same release of a DNAPL will find its way into the fractures in the source zone, represented by the orange, partition into the different phases, as well as migrating down gradient and similarly partitioning. So this slide here shows a graphical illustration of a CSM. There's a lot of detail here. And the point is not to go over the details so much as to point out that it is highly detailed and has its place in making your decisions. However, if you superimpose the 21 compartment model across the bottom, it's possible, which doesn't take very long, it's possible to see at a glance where the most of the mass is held up, which compartments, and this can help bring focus to setting characterization objectives, screening technologies, and so forth. And there's more on this in the guidance document. But that ends the discussion of fate and transport. Tamsin Beth will speak next on CSMs, but I believe we have an opportunity for questions.
Yes, thank you, Ted, and all the other trainers that Melissa, John, and Dave as well. We will now begin our first question and answer portion of our training. So remember, at any time during the training, put your questions in the Q&A box on the bottom of your screen, and we will get to them either through the live portion or chat. Right, so we have one question right now. Can you mention how fracture infilling mineralogy can affect the flow?
This is John. I'll take a crack at that. Fracture infilling is common, and we tend to conceptualize fractures. Or one way that fractures can be conceptualized is as parallel plates. There's a so-called parallel plate model that's used and sometimes. But as a matter of fact, the fractures, they're rough, and they the surfaces are rough. There's infilling. The fractures are in contact. So it's a very irregular surface. So the more infilling there is, and to answer your question more directly, the more it's going to reduce the transmissivity of the fracture. Obviously, we can see some of that on the borehole wall and in outcrop, but it's very difficult, if not impractical, to know how extensive it is, throughout the whole system. So it's just one of those things that comes along with the fracture itself.
Thank you, John. So we do not have any more questions at this time, and we will have another question and answer period at the end of the training. So with that, we will close this question and answer portion and move on to the next section. But before we do that, I did want to have a quick reminder for everybody that is interested in receiving certificates of completion. They are available at the end of the training. When you complete the feedback form, make sure you check the box to certify that you participated, and it will be provided to you. Also, ITRC archives all of its trainings, so if you have any additional time or are looking for any other training opportunities, please visit CLUIN's website and the archive training page to see all the other courses that might interest you. So with that, I'm going to pass it off to Tamsin to continue us in our training.
All right, thank you, Devin. So moving along in our guide here. Devin, can you give me control?
I did, it says it's waiting for you. Maybe just try, yep. You got it, perfect.
All right, there we go. Devin, I still can't advance the slides.
One second, Tamsin. Okay. Okay, try now, Tamsin. If not, I can do it for you.
Nope, that looks like it's going to work now. Aha, there we go. Okay, so moving along in our roadmap for the ITRC guidance, we've gone through the characteristics of fractured rock sites and the differences between fractured rock sites and unconsolidated sites. And in this section, we're going to go through the skills, the approaches, and the tools that are available to actually characterize these sites. One thing of note is that when you're building a fractured rock conceptual site model, it's important to understand that the guidance document is not really a start to finish cookbook, if you will. It's understood that there's a framework, which is shown on the right, for how to approach characterizing a site. And this is actually a flow diagram we developed for the integrated site characterization, which discusses the key elements of building a characterization program. So we're going to go through each of these and talk specifically about how fractured rock sites, or how to approach each of these steps for fractured rock sites. So the first element in building your fractured rock conceptual site model is to first iteratively develop and assess the conceptual site model. We've talked a lot about that in the training thus far. There's lots of elements that you need to consider, and that really helps inform your problem statement. So once you have compiled all your data, you've looked at all these elements, used things like the 21 compartment model, now you can start to understand where your data gaps are, what are your needs, and the resolution of data that you need to fill those data gaps. And that then informs your data quality objectives, which we go through a lot in section 5.4 of the guidance document. Those data quality objectives define the type of information you need, the tools and technologies to fill that informational need, and defines the quality of the data that you need. And based on that, you can select tools and techniques to fill that data gap. And then ultimately, you know, interpretation and data evaluation. So in developing your fractured rock conceptual site model, you're first going to go through the characterization objectives again, the data gap resolution, establish your data quality objectives. And then in this section, we're going to go through one of the tools that we developed, and that's the tools table that I'll talk about in a little bit. In terms of significant data gaps, it's important to understand, again, looking at that 21 compartment model where you have missing or incomplete information that's posing risk to the decisions that you're trying to make for your remedy. Those are also likely to exist if more than one conceptual site model can be supported by the data. Very often, you get some information and there's still a lack of clarity about how that fits into your conceptual site models. So some examples of objectives that you might have for your characterization program are things like, you know, that we typically define, like looking at the lateral and vertical extent of contamination in soil and groundwater and sediment, identifying the data gaps. In this case, it may be associated with delineating those extents within that media, and then building your data collection objective to define things like sources, the relationship between source and chemical transport and your receptors, and then feeding in the fractured rock specific information that you need, like fracture locations, fracture orientation, and chemical concentration. So we built a tool in this guidance to help you with that, to really help you map your data quality objectives with the tools and the technologies that are available to fill those data quality objectives. And this, we built this tool selection matrix. It's a downloadable Excel spreadsheet that goes through all the different characterization tools available to you and gives you a process to screen those tools and decide whether they might make sense to incorporate into your characterization program. So here's the interface of the tools matrix. It contains over 100 tools, and those tools are sorted by the type of tool, the characterization objective, things like tools that provide information on geology, on hydrogeology, on chemistry. It also defines the tools' applicability in different environments like unconsolidated media versus bedrock, or in the unsaturated zone versus the saturated zone. Again, it also defines the data quality. Is the tool or technology quantitative, semi-quantitative, or qualitative? So when you open up this Excel table, you're going to see a view like this, where you've got the tool on the far left, your data quality in the second column, the type of environment, whether it's bedrock or unconsolidated, and whether you're in the saturated or unsaturated zone. One of the cool features is you can click on these different elements and any box, really, and this brings up a description or definition. In this case, this is the geology, and it brings up this description of what geology means in this context. So that can be really helpful. You can also click on any of the tools in the table, and that brings up information on what that tool is. It gives you a description of the tool. It gives you more information about the data quality and the applicability and advantages or limitations of the tool, which is important when you're trying to establish whether something might be applicable for your site. And it also provides the tools or the references that's available. So if you want to go out and get more information about that tool, you have those resources available to you. This provides an example of what the tool output provides. So you go through, you check boxes based on the information or your data quality objectives, and then you get an output that's shown in here. So in this case, we have an output for some geophysics tools, surface geophysics. This provides, the green boxes indicate whether that tool provides information about things like lithology, lithologic contacts, porosity, permeability, fault. So we've got all these elements, right, that you might want to get information for. And this tool is really great for telling you which of these tools can fill that overall characterization objective. So now that you have gone through, established your data quality objectives, screened technologies, and implemented your program, it's also important to ensure, as part of the planning process overall, that you're evaluating the data that you're getting and developing your approach for data evaluation. This is an example of an integrated borehole log, which is a really important tool for integrating multiple data sets with information that we typically collect in fractured rock boreholes. John Dougherty is going to go through this in a lot more detail, so I'm just going to provide an overview. But really, in general, this goes through the typical rock core data that you get, where you've got a common vertical scale and datum going from left to right. Then you have your rock core and caliper log are arranged to the left. Televiewer logs are placed next to those to make it easier to evaluate the same section of the borehole within these different logs. And then you can align things like fluid temperature and fluid conductivity so that you can assess inflections in both of those properties along with structural data like the advanced technology video or ATV and OTV logs, which can be used to determine features such as fractures, whether fractures are infilled. So really aligning these multiple data sets then allows you to do a lot of interpretation and to get an understanding of things like fracturing, bedding planes, joints, and to understand the characteristics of the fractures themselves, like their dip angle, dip azimuth, and apertures. So you can collectively then evaluate all of these data and then get these summary interpretations, things like getting feature orientation data and curves in tadpole plots, which is also shown. And that can be used to select things like heat pulse flow meter locations and give you an overall view of what your fracture orientations and hydraulics look like, which fractures are conveying water or saturated and which aren't. And I'll go through an example of some of this information. Another important element of your conceptual site model and data evaluation is the plan view map. And this is an example. This can be used to depict the lateral component of your three-dimensional conceptual site model. Multiple maps can be prepared to encompass the regional features that was discussed earlier in the training, but can also give you a lot of specific detail. So you can look at regional maps to understand lineaments, watersheds, surface water bodies, wells, and then hone in as necessary. Another important element of your conceptual site model is the cross-section. And geologic cross-sections can be positioned and aligned to take maximum advantage of available information like borehole logs to best represent the geology, to help you understand things like folds and faults and contaminant transport, groundwater flow direction, and the relationship between them. Relevant data, however, are commonly situated off the cross-section, and so you can also project information onto the section line. And we often do this with things like groundwater monitoring wells so that we can evaluate those features that may be important to include in that cross-section. You can also intersect cross-sections, and in fact, there's a lot of 3D visualization tools now that allow you to take paper cross-sections, bring them into the tool. So if you have multiple cross-sections, that gives you a lot more information and helps you constrain your geologic model. And then you can use some of the 3D visualization tools to actually map three-dimensional surfaces of important components of your geologic model. In this case, you know, you might be able to map things like your overburden or your saprolitic zone or your fracture bedrock, and even getting down to mapping out individual fracture zones. So in building your characterization program, we're going to just go through a few steps that's developed in the guidance document in terms of how to build the program. And of course, the first thing that you want to do in your project planning is to develop and implement a work plan. This will allow you to integrate the evaluations that you've done to select the tools, hopefully using the tool selection table that I went through, the means and methods for implementing the characterization program, defining things like drilling methods, and also the evaluations like assessing things like rock core or doing geophysics collectively within one document. In addition, there's some special considerations, I would say, for developing a fractured rock characterization work plan. As always, it needs to emphasize the characterization and data quality objectives and provide a lot of detail in terms of how you're going to evaluate data, to also consider carefully what kinds of post-characterization models. I mentioned the 3D visualization models. There's also contaminant fate and transport models, and all of those have different data needs. And so you want to ensure that all of the data that you need, the parameters to do that modeling, are included as part of your plan and considered. One of the things that ITRC has endorsed or advocated since the very, you know, inception of some of these guidance documents, including some of the first ones that Dave mentioned. We did the mass flux and mass discharge and the integrated DNAPL site strategy document, is this concept of a dynamic field approach to characterization. And it's really in some ways even more important for fractured rock sites because these sites are complex. And so you wanna consider to make your field programs more efficient, things like real-time data assessment, very frequent project team calls where they can get on the line, you can see what information you're getting in the field program and really make real-time decisions about where you need to go and what the next steps are as you're implementing that program. It allows you to be very adaptive and often more efficient in collecting that information that you need. So if real-time or near real-time data are being generated, they can be evaluated to help guide those further data acquisition activities. One of the things that we also want to highlight is to make sure that your characterization program is designed to not spread contamination. I've been involved in a number of projects where I come in to do something like a tiger team review for a deep fractured bedrock, and there are boreholes that have been drilled through things like DNAPL source zones that were never lined or protected. And so in those cases, those boreholes served as conduits for contamination to migrate to even deeper levels, in one case, hundreds of feet deep, which is obviously counter to what we're all trying to achieve in our environmental programs. So it's really important not to leave open holes where you can have this vertical conduit created that can spread contamination. So now we're going to go through a case study that is integrating all of these concepts that we've been talking about thus far, how to understand or develop a conceptual site model. This is a complex fractured bedrock system, and to really understand how some of these unique features of a bedrock conceptual site model can affect remedy decision-making. The site is the Solvents Recovery Service of New England Superfund site. It's in Southington, Connecticut, approximately 15 miles southwest of the city of Hartford. This is a site that processed more than 100 million gallons of solvents, fuels, paints, and other organic liquids between 1955 and 1991. Steel bottom discharges to lagoons and other releases produced NAPLs, and in this case, DNAPL source zones and associated groundwater plumes in overburden and fractured bedrock. The plumes of VOCs above drinking water standards were hydraulically controlled by a pump and treat system that was installed in 1998. And there's been ongoing extensive studies done at this site to continue to develop the remedies. So this site, this is a bedrock map of the site, a bedrock geologic map. It consists of Upper Triassic New Haven Arkose or red beds, which you can see in the figure. The bedrock fractures in the region dip moderately east-southeast and parallel to bedding. And steeply dipping fractures have been observed in outcrops. So Dave talked a lot about using those outcrops for your overall regional interpretation, which has also been consistent in core samples and downhole fracture logging within the study area. The bedrock investigation methods implemented at this site included things like advancing many boreholes. We'll talk about an episode where 41 boreholes were advanced to do detailed borehole characterization, including optical and acoustic televiewer logging, to develop fracture orientation stereo nets, to do rock core sampling and laboratory analysis to assess things like matrix parameters and VOC solute transport parameters, things to get porosity, bulk density, organic carbon, and then to also assess fracture aperture calculations to really understand the fracture orientation and characterize the fractures conveying the contaminant plume at the site. So as I mentioned, there were 41 borehole logs advanced. So the first piece was to really evaluate the bedrock conceptual site model. This is a cross-section perpendicular to the inferred strike of fractures, which is the primary groundwater flow direction, and the dip. And so taking the calculated vertical and horizontal anisotropy, they evaluated a rough approximation of R, and using the dip angle of 20, provided an anisotropy value of 1 to 20, which was important in the modeling that they were doing for the remediation system. In addition, this is a summary of the in-situ fracture orientation data that were collected. Fracture orientations, hydraulic aperture, spacing, and hydraulic conductivities were evaluated. This is an example, this figure of the borehole image processing system, or BIPS data, collected at three deep bedrock holes. There were 94 fractures observed in these boreholes, and the mean dip direction was 107 degrees east-southeast, and the mean dip angle was 22 degrees. Most of the fractures observed in these cores samples paralleled bedding. Based on the number of fractures and the hydraulic conductivity values obtained from 41 injection and extraction well packer tests, the mean fracture aperture spacing was determined to be about 97 microns and 155 centimeters. And this translated to a mean fracture porosity equal to 0.0063%. And this is very characteristic of a lot of fractured rock sites where you have very, very low overall fracture porosity. So this is a plan view map of the hydraulic gradient in bedrock. This was the original interpretation where you have the source area shown in red. You've got your standard potentiometric contours. And in general, the interpretation of these maps is that groundwater flow was migrating towards the Kennepec River, and generally was south from the source area by interpreting this information. However, if you look at this figure, so we have the source area again, and now we have the outline of the contaminant plume. And one of the things that you'll notice is that the contaminant and contaminant plumes in general are really good tracers. So obviously the groundwater plume migration varied quite a lot based on what would be predicted by interpreting the potentiometric surface map. And that really is because in this case, you have this average bedrock fracture orientation, and it really was this the structure of the fractures that dominated the contaminant and groundwater transport. And so as you can see, that created a condition where although the gradient indicated groundwater flow south, the actual groundwater flow was more west, which again is important when you're looking at modeling. In addition, I'll highlight the starred area. That is the original source area, and that was characterized for, again, DNAPLs. This is a 3D mining visualization system model looking north-northeast along the average strike of the bedrock fractures and showing the shape of the interpreted bedrock DNAPL zone. Specific 3D locations within the visible DNAPL and sheens in bedrock are also shown. And in general, their locations align well with the average bedrock fracture orientation. As Ted showed earlier in the demonstration, the fracture orientations really dictate how DNAPL migrates. And this case study exemplified really that DNAPL migrated down dip, and where it existed, it dissolved and contributed to a very deep groundwater plume. Based on some of the original characterization, they drilled boreholes as deep as 450 feet. But due to the complexity of the Dean Apple, the delineation could not be considered definitive. So in this case, you have very, very deep impacts. So this is a figure showing the fracture hydraulic aperture versus depth below bedrock. This figure summarizes the calculated bedrock fracture aperture versus depth. Each black data point represents a bedrock borehole interval where the mean hydraulic fracture aperture was calculated based on the measure interval conductivity and the average fracture spacing. The red dots indicate that the fracture aperture at the specified interval was below the indicated value because the hydraulic conductivity was below the lower limit. So in general, this represents something that's very characteristic at a lot of fractured rock sites, and that is generally that the aperture size or width generally decreases with depth. And it's very consistent for a lot of things like sandstones and shales. And it has to do with the weight of the overlying rock and that effective stress, which tends to cause those fracture apertures to deform and flatten. And so that was very characteristic of this site as well. So based on all of this detailed characterization, these important parameters that I talked about that you feed into things like your models, were obtained, things like bulk permeability, matrix porosity, the fraction of organic carbon, fracture aperture and spacing and porosity that then can be developed into a conceptual site model to decide what to or how to manage the remedy for this site. And so with that, I'm actually going to turn it over to Dan to present the next phase of the training.
Okay, let's see if I have control now. Thank you, Tamsin. Give it a second to catch up. Okay, so up until this point, we've heard John talk about the geology of fractured rock sites. Melissa introduced a lot of very important concepts regarding hydrology of fractured rock sites and how that's very different from traditional overburden types of sites that we deal with. Ted introduced a number of concepts about fate and transport of contaminants and how they're very different in fractured rock environments than in granular overburden. And finally, Tamsin pulled all of that information together to drive home some important concepts about conceptual site models for fractured rock, and some tools are available to us. So the next step, I mean, now we know what's there, we know where it is, we have a really good idea of just sort of the distribution of the contaminants and the geological and geochemical conditions. Now we got to figure out what we're going to do. So section six, this section I'll talk about in the next few minutes, is about remedy selection. So as we think about remedies for fractured rock sites, a couple of really important initial concepts. First, you know, attain a prescriptive level like an MCL, for example, or very, very low concentration is generally going to be a lot more challenging in a fractured rock environment than in an overburden rock environment or overburden environment for many of the reasons that have been outlined earlier in the presentation today. So because of that, we really want to focus on what we call SMART remedial objectives. And that acronym was introduced earlier where it stands for, you can see down here in the lower right-hand corner, specific, measurable, applicable, relevant, and time-bound. So when we think about our SMART remedial objectives and risk reductions, then we can begin to think about remedies that have reasonable timeframes and costs. And reasonable is a relative term with respect to fractured rock, as we'll talk about later on. But yet we can use these to really tackle the most critical risks, to foster partial cleanups that will address those risks and address community concerns to make progress towards complete restoration. So let's start with how we establish those remedial action objectives. So SMART RAOs and risk reduction, for example, can consider some of these four points here, such as groundwater discharge to surface water, vapor discharge, mass flux zones, and source zones. We can use these to identify areas that we want to target preferentially for the remedy in order to protect human health or ecological risk reduction, for example. Or if we're targeting mass flux zones and those source zones, we're perhaps trying to reduce the time to completion for the remedy. But regardless of all these, we have to acknowledge with bedrock, there's typically going to be an awful lot of uncertainty, more so than we would normally expect in a granular overburden, just because of the uncertainties related to the distribution of fractures and where those fractures begin and end and how fluids will move through them. So because of that, we also need to develop a contingency plan. All right, so let's talk about some special considerations in fractured rock. So those are summarized on this table, and particularly how they're different at fractured rock compared to overburden. So for example, when we think about hydraulic conductivity or mass storage, it can be a much wider range of those values, say compared to a typical overburden site. And because of that, anything that involves or any remedy that involves injection or extraction of a fluid can be a lot more difficult to implement. And so I summarized a number of these additional characteristics and how they affect remedy selection or remedy design. Bottom line, all of these characteristics are very different from overburden. And so they can make remedy design and implementation in bedrock a bit more challenging than an overburden. So let's go on now. Let's start talking about some of the influences on remedy selection. Well, I think first and foremost, the rock type is often a very critical initial thing to consider. So the rock type really affects the fate and the transport and the storage characteristics and the geochemistry. And therefore, all of these factors are going to influence the remedy and the remedy selection, the remedy design. So differences, for example, in hydraulic characteristics for different rocks, differences in organic carbon content or the types of abiotic reactions that are occurring are great examples. We also need to consider the contaminants that are present. For example, Ted talked about how a Dean apple can migrate in different ways through a fractured rock environment. We have to consider highly soluble contaminants. Something we often don't recognize is that contaminants will actually diffuse into the rock itself. And the more soluble those contaminants are, typically, the more strongly they will diffuse into that matrix. And then subsequently, those materials, for example, once the water moving through that fracture has been largely remediated, you can actually reverse that chemical gradient and subsequently have what we call back diffusion of those contaminants back out of the rock matrix into the groundwater. And so, and by that way, they will continue to sustain the plume for potentially a very, very long time. Napples can be transported very great distances along those fractures. They'll keep going down if the fracture keeps going down, for example. If you recall some of the charts that Ted showed. Instead of just restricted to a small pool or a very discrete source area, it can be smeared across quite a large area within a fractured rock environment or fractured rock aquifer. And finally, an important thing that can think about is the water and contaminant and rock interactions in fractured rock environment are going to be very, very different. And this is because of the surface area. When you think about water moving through a fracture, it's exposed, the water is exposed to interaction with the rock just on the faces of that fracture. And so it's relatively limited. When you contrast that, for example, with a granular overburden aquifer where water is moving around each of those individual grains. And because of that, the surface area of the solid matrix that the water is exposed to is far, far greater in an overburden environment than it is in fractured rock. And that can affect everything that is going on, whether or not there are abiotic reactions that are affecting the contaminant concentrations, or absorption, desorption of the contaminants, and many other characteristics are affected by these surface area characteristics. Now, please don't try to look at this matrix, right? This is in the document. What I'm going to do is I'm going to walk through this matrix and how it was set up, and then we can talk more about the remedies itself. So what this is basically is it's from the document. It's a technology screening matrix. And what we did as a team is we evaluated a number of different technologies against different types of rock to evaluate whether or not they might be, you know, reasonably expected to be applicable. Now, I also want to emphasize every site is different. Every site has a unique site, a unique set of characteristics and challenges. There might be risk options to consider, things of that nature that can affect the technology screening itself. So we've tried to make some very general recommendations, but by no means should these be considered absolute. So first, what we'll do is we'll zoom in on that left side. As I mentioned earlier, the representative type of rock or the primary rock that's present is really a very, very important factor to begin your consideration of what remedy to talk about or what remedy to consider for your site. And that's what we've done here. So we've divided rock types into sedimentary rocks, and igneous and metamorphic rocks, and then divided each of those further based on, you know, really very common types of rock classification matrices. And then we thought about some of the factors that Ted introduced earlier in the 21 compartment model. For example, transmissivity or how well water is going to flow through the rock matrix and the amount of matrix storage that's in those rocks. And so in general, an H will refer to high or an L will refer to low. So for example, here, the bituminous coal rock will have a very high matrix transmissivity but a relatively low amount of fracture transmissivity because bituminous coal doesn't fracture that well. But because of this high matrix transmissivity, you can also have a pretty high matrix storage of contaminants within it. So that's just one simple example, but you can see what the generalizations we've made for different types of contaminants in these types of rocks. So next, let's move on to the range of technologies, and that goes across the top. So we've selected a good representative range of technologies that are applicable in fractured rock, including physical technologies, such as just outright removal, thermal air sparge, where you're basically physically removing the contaminant. And we've considered containment technologies such as a pump and treat system or permeable reactive barrier type systems, where you're basically trying to contain a plume from spreading further. And we've considered some chemical and biological remedies where you're trying to actually destroy the contaminant found in the bedrock. So that goes across the top. And so between the two, the rock characteristics on the left and going across for different types of remedies, we then evaluated each of the individual remedies based on what we would believe their applicability would be based on our experience and range of experiences at these sites. So for example, we would assign a Y as yes or generally applicable, meaning this particular type of remedy would be generally applicable in this particular type of rock. And again, I want to be very careful and emphasize that it's a very site-specific determination in that respect. And then N, be generally not applicable for a variety of different reasons. And a U, meaning, you know, it might actually be applicable, but we're not sure that this is a type of remedy that might be applied at the site. So now let's move on to consideration of some of the specific technologies. Let's start with the physical technologies and begin just with removal. You know, you can actually physically remove contaminated fractured rock. Now, generally, this is limited to pretty soft or you know, very highly weathered rock, what we might call rippable, so they could be, you know, basically removed. And this can be a good approach for a high matrix storage or high primary porosity type of rock. So that you know that you know you're getting good results for the removal. Thermal methods there are a range of different types of thermal methods, and they have different advantages and disadvantages for different types of rock. And so, for example, you know, you may use electrical resistance heating if you have a large amount of fluid. Thermal conductive heating might be very applicable for certain types of rocks where there's not quite as much fluid, for example. Air sparge is a very commonly used or a relatively commonly used method, but you have to be very careful with air sparge because distribution pathways are likely to be very limited by the fracture distribution. Vapor and multi-phase extraction techniques, both are commonly applied in bedrock. Their design, again, can be very challenging because of discrete fracture distribution, and they're commonly associated with other technologies. For example, both of these are commonly co-applied with thermal methods or with a chemical oxidation method such as hydrogen peroxide injection, which can typically be associated with a lot of off-gas production. Think about surfactant or co-solvent flushing. So this can be really, really challenging in fractured rock because of heterogeneous fluid flow. You'll get preferential migration through very large aperture fractures, but a very important characteristic is that you're probably going to get very little or no contact with NAPL in less transmissive fracture zones. Basically, the co-solvent or the surfactant will just literally flow past them with, again, very little surface area to interface with the NAPL, or just avoid them completely because of preferential flow paths. And because of this, in an ITRC document that discussed surfactant and co-solvent flushing, ITRC actually recommended against application of this type of a remedy in fractured rock aquifers. Pump and treat is also very widely applied, but we have to think about some special rock considerations. Communication with overburden or weathered bedrock can be very relevant in the design. The fracture orientations and anisotropy and fluid flow, for example, the solvent recovery site that Tamsin introduced, that I'll talk about again in a few moments, is a great example of that, of how the contaminant migration path seems to be moving in a very different direction from what you would expect based on head measurements in the aquifer. And so that's being influenced by these fracture orientations and multiple intersecting fracture sets. You've seen some of the photographs of fractured rock that we've showed. You can see many different directions for the fractures that may intersect in very complex ways. And so because of that, the capture zone geometry can be a lot more complex than an overburdened aquifer. So you have to very carefully consider your modeling, your hydraulic head measurements to calibrate your models. And finally, there's groundwater contaminant concentrations. Permeable reactive barrier zones can also be applied basically by injecting a solid reagent into discrete fractures. This is not a straightforward type of remedy, but it can be applied successfully. It requires very accurate fracture identification and depth resolution. Think about it this way. You're trying to target a fracture that is a quarter of an inch, and maybe let's say that fracture is 100 feet below grade. So trying to very specifically identify that zone so you can target it for an injection can be tricky, but there are ways to do it. And it basically comes down to very careful coring and logging to identify those depths, and then some very specialized methods of injection to target them very, very well. But it can be ineffective if a very transmissive fracture zone is missed. The injected media can also affect fluid flow. Think about it. You're putting a reactive media, typically a solid, into a fracture that is transmitting water, and that will affect the transmissivity of the fracture. So these types of technologies might be considered to be most applicable at sites with significant amount of secondary porosity. That, in other words, that's water moving through those fractures rather than through the primary matrix in the rock itself. Chemical and biological approaches, such as chemical oxidation or chemical reduction, are also pretty widely applied in fractured rock. And there are a number of ITRC guidance documents about application of these technologies that do talk about fractured rock environments. And as we've been talking about with the complexities of fluid flow, those will also affect the chemical oxidants or the chemical reductant reagents that are being injected. They'll move primarily through these secondary porosity, the fracture itself, with very little influence with the primary porosity or the matrix storage domains where the contaminant is diffused into the rock itself. The fracture orientation will control where the reagents are going to go. And you can have, in some cases, density-driven flow as well. For example, permanganate solutions that might be, let's say, 8 or 10% concentrations of permanganate are denser than water. They're going to somewhat act like a DNAPL, for example, when you inject that into a fracture, which may or may not be a very good characteristic, depending upon your particular situation. Now, an advantage of these is that very long-lived oxidants can diffuse, or can, excuse me, can diffusively penetrate into rock. And this has been shown a number of times, for example, with permanganate, which is easy to see. After an injection of permanganate, collecting a core that intersects a fracture that permanganate was moving through, you can actually see a little diffusive kind of a rind of permanganate where it's actually migrated into the rock. And that can be really important to control that back diffusion issue that I talked about earlier on. Napples, if you're trying to target napples with these types of technologies, again, it's a surface area of factor. And your chemical oxidants, for example, if they are fortunate enough to basically encounter the napple directly, they have very little surface area with relatively little surface area with which to react with that napple. And so that can really limit the ability to use these technologies. So let's talk about bioremediation or modern natural attenuation. These are also very widely applied. If you are using a reagent, you know, a chemical substrate, for example, for bioremediation, you may have the same types of reagent distribution challenges. We have to think about the microbial distribution between groundwater and the primary porosity. What we have found is there are actually a few studies that have found that microbes can actually live within that primary porosity, within the rock matrix itself, and not just limited to, say, a biofilm on the fracture surface. It's not really well known, but there can be some very, very active microbial populations found within fractured rock matrices. And finally, combined remedies. I think this is really important because the remedial paradigm, I think, that we face today is really shifted over the last 10 or 15 years. You know, I remember when I got involved in this business a long time ago, the thought was you'd use one technology to carry a project from cradle to grave, from DNAPL concentrations down to drinking water standards. And what we found is that's really no longer the paradigm. We've shifted to an approach where you typically utilize combined remedies almost always, because different remedies have different strengths. We want to, you know, really emphasize those strengths and minimize our weaknesses, both for more effective, technically effective, and cost-effective remedies. But rock often requires, you know, some out-of-the-box approaches compared to overburden. You know, for example, you have to think about spatial or temporal separation of those remedies. You know, whether you apply remedy one in the source and remedy two in the plume, or whether or not you're going to apply remedy one first, followed by remedy two, and how those will interact with each other. And the 21 compartment model that Ted introduced earlier in the in this training might help with that as well. And let's also talk for a few minutes about bench test and field pilot test considerations. So certainly bench and field pilot tests can provide some really important and relevant data regarding the treatability of the contaminants and rock chemistry interactions and reagent distributions, for example, and can give you a basis to evaluate whether or not your remedial design or the technology you've selected might achieve your remedial goals. But there are some really, really important characteristics to think about that are different. I've seen a number of cases where people have performed some type of remediation bench test for fractured rock, in which they took the fractured rock sample and crushed it. And they would crush the rock, and then they would evaluate whatever remedy that they were thinking about, say, for example, a chemical oxidation remedy. Well, what happens is when you crush the rock is you now expose a vast amount of additional surface area in that rock around those individual grains, which doesn't exist in the environment. So you've changed those water-rock interaction characteristics on surface area alone. And finally, that much of that surface area is now this very fresh, unweathered surface that's going to react very, very differently from, compared to interactions on a fracture face, which has been exposed to contaminants and moving water for a very long time. It's going to be a very weathered surface as contrasted with a very, very fresh surface. So you really want to avoid using crushed rock. You can perform these types of tests for a bench test using cores to collect the fractures and then protecting the drilled faces of that fracture so that only the fracture face is exposed to whatever reagent you're considering. And finally, when we're thinking about pilot tests, small scale pilot tests, you have to really bear in mind the groundwater flow can be so much different in fractured rock that your reagents, for example, or the effects of your reagents or whatever remedy you're doing, you may not observe them very easily just because of anisotropy and lack of clarity about where exactly the water or the reagents are moving. So let's go back to the SRSNE case study that Tamsin introduced. We'll talk a little bit more about that. We'll talk about how the remedy selection at this site came to hydraulic containment to support the remedial design for the VOCs in groundwater. And we'll talk about the multiple lines of evidence that were used to confirm that the remedy was protective. So this was the map that Tamsin introduced earlier. Recall that north in this case is to the right, okay? South is to the left. So what was started with was, all right, an understanding of how water is moving at the site was developed based on a regional flow model, both a regional and a local flow model, to determine just how water is moving. So you can see particle traces migrating through the aquifer in this case, and how they were being collected by a series of extraction wells installed through the site, three in the overburden and one in the bedrock. Now we're targeting a bedrock remedy, but at this site, as you move to the south, and again, that's to the left, the bedrock aquifer, the groundwater moving through the bedrock aquifer begins to come up into the overburden. So that extraction wells installed in the overburden were very, very effective at collecting or extracting the groundwater. And this capture zone boundary was first defined based on modeling, but was later confirmed by hydraulic head measurements. So you could actually confirm the capture zones. And then also by, you know, the simple fact that groundwater monitoring wells installed outside this capture zone boundary weren't impacted by the contaminants of concern. So we had this combination of modeling and actual measurements to confirm what our model predictions were telling us. Now, let's also think about the remedy selection in the first place. Modeling that was conducted as part of the feasibility study showed that it may take as long as 225 years or more for this plume to naturally attenuate, or for the denample to dissolve, so that the groundwater VOC concentration can attenuate. So that period of time was written into the record of decision for the remedial time frame. But what we're finding is it's actually the remedy is progressing at a much faster rate than was predicted, because the dissolution of the denapple seems to be occurring a bit more quickly than was expected. And the extraction is operated at a rate of about 30 gallons per minute to ensure that they have capture of the groundwater in this example. So now let's talk about monitoring of that remedy. So how we need to continue to make sure that the remedy is performing as designed and it's remaining protective. So those monitored natural attenuation parameters, I should back up. Monitored natural attenuation is an important factor for the design, so that adds to the ability of the groundwater extraction system to address the groundwater plume. Those parameters are monitored every 2 years at wells, both inside and outside of the capture zone, to ensure that the monitored natural attenuation is continuing to occur. And so VOC, dioxane, and tetrahydrofuran concentrations and trends are all part of those analyses. And we do see that the concentrations are decreasing, even directly downgrading from the denample zone. And, you know, some of the more modern techniques, quantitative polymerase chain reaction analyses are utilized to demonstrate that the actual microbes that we know degrade these contaminants are present at the site. So now I'm going to turn it back over to John Dougherty, who is now going to talk about monitoring of these plumes.
Thank you, Dan. So a successful groundwater monitoring strategy at a fractured bedrock site is rooted in the results of the site characterization, to ensure that the rem and the goal is to ensure that the remedy attains site-specific goals. There are three types of monitoring: compliance, operational, and progress or performance monitoring. Compliance monitoring focuses on meeting regulatory requirements. Operational monitoring assesses the function of the remediation system. And performance monitoring assesses the effectiveness of the remedy. In other words, progress towards the remedial objectives. Media that can be monitored include those related to compliance, operational, and performance objectives. And these will include groundwater and surface water. They may also include soil gas. All three of these can be critical to receptors. You may also want to monitor aquifer matrix materials from time to time to assess things like mass removal for during a thermal remedy. Monitoring network design considers the rock type, first of all, whether it's igneous, sedimentary, or metamorphic, the orientation of transmissive features such as fractures and bedding planes, and the location of receptors. The locations where monitoring is conducted, again, are rooted on our site conceptual model and considers the orientation of the transmissive features in rock, these features create the anisotropy in the system. And a stereo net is an effective tool to use to evaluate the orientation of these features, both from individual boreholes and from multiple boreholes to help you assess things on a site-wide basis. We have to have an understanding of what the hydraulic gradient is and the groundwater flow direction and how rock anisotropy may be impacting the groundwater flow direction. And of course, the geochemistry, including contaminants and other parameters that we're going to use to monitor the effectiveness of the remedy, such as dissolved oxygen, ferrous iron, nitrate, et cetera. So monitoring locations obviously include source zone, impacted zones, boundaries, upgradient areas, cross gradient, and sentinel locations. This is an example of an integrated borehole geophysical log, which Tamsin showed earlier, and it combines borehole geophysical data as well as data from other tools and from typically multiple contractors at a site. So in this example, we have information from the rock core on the left, including recovery lithology. We have a suite of borehole geophysical logs and the interpretation of some of those logs, which I'll talk about. And then a flute transmissivity profile, packer testing, and finally a well design here for a water flute. Now, in general, after drilling, the borehole should be lined using a blank flute liner to prevent vertical groundwater flow, which can allow contaminants to move from a contaminated hydrostratigraphic unit into an uncontaminated unit. The liner is then removed the day before logging to allow the borehole to stabilize. And then for the kind of characterization that we do for hydrogeologic analysis at fractured bedrock sites, the logging is typically going to proceed in two phases. We're first going to run the optical televiewer. First we're going to run fluid temperature and conductivity, which you see here, because we want the borehole to be undisturbed. Then the optical televiewer, because we want optically clear water, and then acoustic televiewer, and then other logs like natural gamma and electric logs, which are shown here. These logs are analyzed in the field to try to identify potentially transmissive features. For example, on the log here, you can see these features, which are indicative of fracture, or maybe an open zone in the rock here. So we would target these for heat pulse flow meter logging. On the log here, you can see squares, which indicate where the heat pulse flow meter data is collected. To do a heat pulse flow meter log, you lower the tool in the borehole, position it at the stop, above the feature, take a reading, and then move it to the next stop, take another reading, and repeat that process down the borehole. Then we pump water from the borehole at a low flow rate of about a gallon a minute, typically, to perturb the head in the borehole, which can cause fractures to produce water because now we've changed the head in the borehole. And that's what the red trace shows here. We repeat our readings at the same intervals. Now, post field work, we analyze the borehole log, particularly the OTD and the ATD. We have tools in the software that we can fit sine waves to these features and then produce a feature log, which is shown here as a tadpole plot. These blue diamonds indicate the dip of the feature, starting from zero on the left to 90 degrees on the right. So this is a steeply dipping feature here, flat line feature here. And the tails of the tadpoles point in the direction of dip azimuth. We also have the interpretation of the heat pulse flow meter log here, shown by the red and blue lines. And what this is showing us is that the fractures down here at about this interval here are starting to produce water under pumped conditions. There's additional flow into the borehole here, probably related to this feature. You can see on the acoustic caliper right here, it shows a deflection there. And then we have more input into the borehole between these stations, probably related to this feature here. We also have a flue transmissivity profile, which gives us additional information on the transmissivity distribution of the borehole. Again, here, for example, we see a relatively high transmissivity lining up with this feature. So what the integrated borehole geophysical log allows us to do is look at all this information together and line it up. Finally, with our Packer test results, and then we design a well, in this case, a water flute with multiple screened intervals. So that tool that I just showed you, of course, is applied during characterization and also during the development of our monitoring program. So, the goal of monitoring is to evaluate the operation of the remedy, progress towards remedial objectives, attainment of those remedial objectives and cleanup levels. Let's look at the Greenville case study. At this site, the groundwater and surface water are being monitored. There are two hydrostratigraphic units, weathered bedrock and competent rock with low matrix porosity. So for example, an igneous rock. When considering monitoring, the monitoring network design, we have fracture orientation, subhorizontal, probably a bedding plane, meaning it's flat lying, and the water-bearing fractures were readily identified. And then the monitoring network consisted of 15 wells in the source area, 37 in the impacted zone. Wells were installed up gradient, cross gradient, and at sentinel locations. And wells were installed up and down gradient of the ZVI barrier to monitor remedy progress. And finally, surface water monitoring was performed down gradient. So, using this case study as an example from SRSNE, we're going to see how the monitoring at this site was designed, recognize methods that can be used to reduce the cost, and appreciate how historical data can also be used. So at this site, bedrock wells were installed in shallow bedrock and deep bedrock based on core Packer testing and borehole geophysical logs. Annual sampling has been conducted for VOCs from a subset of wells, and comprehensive sampling is performed every 5 years. So there's quite a lot of data from a site like this. This graph shows historical trends in total VOC concentrations using all available data. And this graph here shows that we can still see the same trends with less data. So statistical analyses were performed to see if we could reduce the sampling program to save costs and without losing the ability to monitor trends over time. And the regulator accepted this approach, which resulted in significant savings to the project. So in summary, our purpose here today has been to try to dispel the myth that fractured bedrock sites can't be remediated. The material we've presented today connects to the ITRC guidance document, which is available online and includes these elements that we've covered today. The tools matrix is a great resource to help you identify site characterization tools based on your site's characteristics. And our goal at ITRC, or the goal of the fractured rock guidance, is to help you develop good conceptual site models, set realistic remedial objectives, select the best remedial options, and monitor progress and assess results so that you and your team can make effective decisions to remediate a site. So thank you for your attention today, and Devin, I'll turn it back to you.
All right, thank you, John. So with that, we will begin our second question and answer portion of the training today. We have a few questions in the chat. If anybody has any that pops into their head, feel free to enter them. First question, which bedrock drilling methodology is the lowest impact and least risk for exacerbating existing fracture network and contributing to vertical migration of contamination?
So Devin, this is John. I think I'll take a crack at that one. And I think I could combine it with an answer to the second question if you want to read that now.
Okay, the second question, yeah.
Okay, so let me try to answer these questions together and say that, first of all, we would definitely not recommend randomly locating borings or wells. We recommend, as we started off early in the presentation today, by looking at the site on a regional basis, looking at the information that's publicly available from geological surveys and whatnot online. So you understand the regional context, then, you know, zoom in closer to the site, look at outcrops and other available information from the site. You know, often there's information about the site. So you can develop your conceptual site model before you begin to think about where you're going to drill. So your drilling locations are guided by your site conceptual model, which includes information on what's the orientation of the bedrock, what's the type of bedrock, where do we expect groundwater to be moving, that kind of thing. Surface geophysical methods can be helpful in helping you decide where to drill. You know, methods that can be used to determine the depth to bedrock and sometimes to locate features like faults. But I think primarily you're going to rely on the available information to help you develop the conceptual site model and define your data quality objectives, which dovetails into the second question here about drilling methodologies. None of the drilling methodologies we typically use are going to exacerbate the existing fracture network. The influence of the drilling is localized, you know, to the borehole in the immediate vicinity. And it's not going to have much of an effect beyond the immediate vicinity of the borehole. So depending on your data quality objectives, for example, you might want to do rock coring to actually collect the physical core, even though we always recommend, or I always recommend, doing borehole geophysical logging, because the core gives you something physical to look at to compare to what you're seeing on your borehole geophysical logs. So that's one method. Air rotary could be used because it's relatively fast. Of course, you can only log from the chips then, and there may be other constraints on that method depending on what kind of sampling you're doing. Sonic drilling can also be used to advance boreholes in bedrock. It gives you a very large core, so it's not the same as an HQ core. It's going to tend to be broken up more as well. As far as preventing vertical migration of contamination, that's a really important concern or consideration that I mentioned in talking about the monitoring program. And really, there's two elements to that. First of all, deciding where you're going to drill in the first place. Do you really need to drill in the source area? And if you're drilling in the source area, how deep do you really need to go? Because you always have a risk of moving contamination deeper. So ways to prevent that include, first of all, deciding where you're going to drill. Don't drill in the source area unless you need to. And then using casing, either permanent or temporary, to case off contaminated zones from lower zones. And then using the blank flute liners to line the borehole temporarily to prevent vertical fluid migration. Thank you.
Thank you, John. All right. We have a few more questions. How would you approach characterization and remedy selection for a site contaminated by both DNAPL and LNAPL?
Hey, Devin, this is Dan. I can I'll tackle part of that one. That's certainly a really, really complex situation. So you have to begin to think about what your what your remedial objectives are going to be, and really start to think about where your risk assessment is, where your risk exposure pathways are, because this is going to be such a complicated situation that, you know, trying to develop characterize a site and develop a remedy for that site that's going to address everything is going to be very, very hard. So begin with your data quality, your risk assessment, to help that identify where you need to focus your approaches, and then move forward from there and think about what, for example, you can use that tool matrix or that technology matrix to start picking apart different and selecting different remedies. But what you have to really bear in mind, I think, is how one remedy is going to affect the other, because more than likely you're going to be targeting more than one remedy. So that would be my suggestion. Start with your risk assessment, identify your risk pathways and your exposure points. And then as you start to think about remedies to target those exposure pathways, and just be very, very cognizant of how the different remedies will affect each other, because that's not necessarily going to be straightforward. It's hard to get a lot much more descriptive than that at this point, not knowing anything about that particular site, but I hope that helps.
Thank you, Dan. All right. We have one last question. What indirect method, i.e. geophysics, is recommended to detect deep horizontal fractures?
Well, this is John. I'll take that one, unless somebody else wants to. I think it's not something I've ever done, try to use borehole or surface geophysics to detect a deep horizontal fracture. What comes to mind is that a seismic method might be applicable if it's significant enough to change the velocity of the seismic waves. Again, I would start by looking at existing information from the site or nearby. If horizontal fractures are significant water-bearing zones, they've probably been drilled into in other wells surrounding the site. And you might, for example, be able to get access to one of those wells and do borehole geophysical logging to help you determine where it is. So I think I'd start with trying to look at existing information and existing wells. The surface geophysical work is relatively expensive and may not give you definitive results.
Thank you, John. All right, so that wraps up our last question and answer portion of today's training. Thank you for attendees for all the questions today, and thank you to our trainers for providing answers and for being here and giving the time to present and act as trainers. If you need further clarification on any answers or if you have any more questions, feel free to email us at training@itrcweb.org, and we can follow up with our trainers to get your questions answered. You are also welcome to follow up with our trainers directly. Just a reminder that we do archive all of our training courses, so if you want to explore any other training opportunities, please visit the Clumen website. There is an entire page of all ITRC's archive trainings that you can choose from. And also, we would love to hear back from you all today at the end of the training session. Please make sure to fill out the feedback form, and that will be how you receive a certificate of completion by checking that little box that you can see on this last screen. It's a little bit small, but by checking that box to certify that you participated. So with that, we will wrap up this training session, and everybody have a wonderful day, and trainers.